Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holidays.
Happy Hanukkah.
You know, we're glad to be back. We took last week off accidentally. We're going to be traveling a lot of places.
Yeah, well, it begins with the Voices of Dentistry.
Voices of Dentistry in January in Scottsdale. If you haven't gotten your ticket, you definitely need to sign up for that. Because that's going to be really fun. That's in Scottsdale. And if you're a student, tickets are super cheap, which is nice.
I think
but
200.
Yeah, lots of fun people to be there. It's going to be a great can't miss meeting. And then Paymon and I will also be at other places speaking throughout the spring. So check out those. Tonight's guest, though, I'm super excited about. Mainly because I've been reading a book that this guy has written, and he kind of knows. I'm pretty impressed. Almost somewhat of a millennial mindset, you know, the whole not wanting to work too hard. So anyways, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Bill Williams.
Sully, thank you for having me on the program, The Millennial Dentist. Thank you, Payment, for
yes,
being
absolutely.
My co-host.
Sure.
Yeah, man, we're glad you're here. So we're going to dive right into this. You know, you're a pretty active guy on the kind of the social media scene with Facebook and all that. You've written a couple books. How many books have you written now?
I just put my third book into print, and I was a principal author on two of those and shared authorship with one.
The 10,000 a Day Dentist is an Amazon bestseller.
We've been pretty fortunate to be the bestseller on both books we put out in dental practice management.
That's incredible.
And this one was released just a month ago.
Congratulations. That is that's awesome. Yes. So we're going to jump into a good bit of this, what's in the book, that sort of thing. But I always like to kind of start episodes with our guests a little bit of telling us their experience, because so many of our listeners obviously are young dentists who are trying to figure out how the heck they're going to make it. I like to let people see different perspectives on how people have got from point A to point B. So let me hand over the mic to you, so to speak, and you kind of tell us a little bit about your journey. What made you get to this point where you're enjoying everything you're doing so much? And we are going to be rude and interrupt you and butt in and ask questions.
I like it. Well, I'll give you the short version. The long version is, I started out in 1975. In dentistry, when I graduated from the Medical College of Georgia.
Not a millennial.
And that is not a millennial year. I mean, I'm a classic boomer.
All right.
And, you know, and I boom with the best of them as far as I started out crashing the gates, trying to get out of the mold of a dental school thinking dentist. I'd been in practice 4 years when I decided this is not the way to go. And so I started.
When you say that, what do you mean? What do you specifically mean?
I was throwing out what I learned in dental school and saying, this is garbage. You know, there were things that we were taught that I didn't think were actually correct. And so I started going to TMJ and orthodontic and all these courses that opened my eyes. It was not everything that was out there.
So you'd be willing to say that you probably learn most of what you actually do and practice on a day-to-day basis, not in CE.
No, I'd say I learned most of what I learned in CE.
Yeah.
After dental school.
Sure. Okay. I would agree.
And then I started teaching back in 1981. And so I found that I love TMJ and orthodontics and reconstruction. So I started teaching, did a couple of tours in Canada and in different places. And started up a mini residency in TMJ back in 1985. And so for the first 10 years of my teaching, it was all about clinical dentistry. And I got burned out on that and decided, well, my practice is doing good, but I think I'll do something different. And I went off to Russia and went to 90s, and was trying to do things that were far, far away from dentistry. While I kept my practice going.
So wait, were you practicing during this time? You're just traveling a lot more? Or how does one decide, hey, I'm going to go to Russia and Indonesia for a while?
You know, when Russia was breaking up perestroika and glasnost was going along pretty good, and everybody thought they were going to go make a fortune over there in the Soviet Union, tear down. Well, we thought we would go there. We built some houses in Moscow. I went to Kazakhstan to drill oil with an oil well, a Wildcatter. I was doing some crazy crap. And, you know, we basically threw a bunch of money in a hole and buried it because we didn't bring any home. We didn't bring any money home. So this is like the entrepreneurial mindset gone off the deep end. That was me. And so it was all based on practice to do all these fun things. And we still had a great nest egg built up and all. And, you know, it took a 10-year period of realizing that you can't make money outside of dentistry if you're a dentist, because you don't know what you're doing outside of dentistry. And so I really came back to my senses in about 1995 and started to really focus. And it was at that point that I realized I was in the wrong part of town. I have 2 million, but it was like stress. And I couldn't keep staff, and it was a troublesome thing. So I sold it, and I moved to a new town 30 miles away and started over at age 48. And my story picks up right there in the book, Marketing the Million Dollar Practice, where I actually catalog the marketing stages that I went through to build the practice from zero to $5.8 million in 10 years.
Wow.
$5.8 million? It was all based on one office.
And we had 4 doctors working in the practice by the time we peaked out. And we decided, well, that's as big as we wanted to grow. We want to stay in one place, one location, not have multiple locations. And we decided we'd stay that way for the next 10, 15 years. So that's pretty much what we've been doing.
Wow. Okay. Where do you even start here? So lots of questions. Okay. So I guess my first question goes back to, you know, it's interesting because you obviously were very unique within your generation. You don't see that a lot. Do you feel like that you're an outlier within your generation? Because I don't see the majority of dentists that are your age aren't spending that much money on CE. They're not kind of going for broke with it. They're kind of dragging their feet. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you had to take risk at certain points to do this. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, think about this. The people you know because you hang around interesting people, interesting places. And I found hanging around the people locally that they were not very interesting and they didn't do many interesting things. When I was talking about local study clubs and local groups. And so it took me about 10 years to figure that out, that I needed to go away from where I was so I could really expand. And so we started a national study club of dentists from all over in Canada too. And we got together about twice a year for 10 straight years. I mean, 10 straight years. So we had about a 6-month period between each visit. And so I really spread my wings when I was in a mastermind of dentists that were from all over the country who were kind of like handpicked, lay it out with each other.
Well, and that's, I mean, we talk about all the time, hey, I want to do that, like, you're really, and this goes to all the listeners, especially, because I think that's a phenomenal point, Dr. Bill, is that you really are a little bit of the five people or so that you hang out with on a regular basis, that you're gonna pick up attributes, whether it's good skills, bad skills, hardworking, not working, with the people you associate with. So, cast and meeting people, I mean, I've already, it has elevated my level of dentistry, marketing, treatment planning, everything.
I mean, everything. It's so true. Like, being with people. Yeah, just what you said about who you hang out with and the great minds is, I feel like the more and more after graduation, I'm meeting people outside of where I live. And I mean, not necessarily Nashville, but from Arizona or different city countries that we meet and realize from them, those folks. Now, some of the things that you learned from these people, was it like you said, 95 was the period that you said that, okay, I got to change this. You switched from teaching into spending time here and building the practices. Is that true? 95?
Yeah, I was rocking along really well for 23 years in my Stone Mountain practice in Atlanta. And I was doing good, but it just wasn't going where I wanted it to go.
Talk more about that. What was not going? Because, I mean, $1 million practice, a lot of dentists would be like, that's great. I'll take that.
Yeah, $1.5 million for one person.
Well, wrong neighborhood. Values of property going down, crime on the street, hard to get my staff to move into the area and come to work, and the patients were not showing up because of the. So it's just a transitional neighborhood that just wasn't conducive to good business.
So you said, basically, I want to build the practice. You want to make the dream practice, basically the dream location and where you want to be and all that sort of thing.
I decided just to pick it up and start over because I knew the future was not where I was.
Now, is that based on dentistry at all? Like, or did you want to do the type of dentistry that you couldn't do in that neighborhood? Or was it dentistry you wanted to do? Because sometimes I think that's the question where some of the folks getting out of school, they're like, if I go to this neighborhood or that, then I won't be doing any implants, or I will be doing this and that. Now, how was your mindset, or what do you think, based on what you have learned so far, is that neighborhood or demographics have to do anything with the type of dentistry you perform?
Not really the neighborhood for the type of dentistry, but it was the compatible to really work and make things more simple. It was just too complex to be in that neighborhood when I couldn't keep my staff and it was always turning over.
Sure.
No, that's huge. So, okay. So what were some of the big, in that initial practice as you built that one, some of the kind of defining moments for you that were like, I guess, kind of pain points that you look back to where, you know, that helped you get there?
Well, I had a 1200 square foot place when I first started out, and I quickly maxed that out and expanded into the, area to get 1600 square feet of space to use and three dentists in this one 1600 square feet. And it was just really jam packed. And so we went from 1600 to 8,500. It really felt like we were in a luxury place, and we had a teaching facility so we could teach our TMJ courses. And it was a great place for about, 15 years. So we stayed there and had a great practice, great time. Every quarter, we'd bring in 20 dentists and their staff, and we would teach about 40 staff and 20 dentists how to do TMJ diagnosis, therapy, finished cases, all that.
I imagine a pretty big financial decision. How did you decide to take the plunge and do that? Because, I mean, you're going, that's a serious commitment when you're going to pack up everything you said, like at 48 years old, because not many people are doing that. To build this kind of mega practice. And did you have other partners that were going to do that with you, or?
Yeah, I was solo. I owned it and all my profit, whatever I had. I had to sell it at a fairly good discount to move, though. You know, I had a building that was worth $1 million and I had a practice worth $1 million something. And I sold the whole thing for a lot less than I could have gotten if the neighborhood had been strong. So the property values during that time were down. I don't regret it. I'm glad I moved, but I came out of there and went into a lease just like I had 23 years previous. And within about 6 months, I was up to 600,000. And the next year I was up to $1.2 million. And we just kept growing at that same pace. And I got to go into a lease space of 3,000 square feet from that 1200. And then I leased another part of that same building and went to 4,000 and got from 5 operatories to 10. And finally, I bought the building that we were in and I made 15 operatories and took over the entire basement also.
For staff. I mean, this sounds incredible. Like, I'm just trying to think of what's your mentality? Like, what is it that makes you so grow so quickly in such a short amount of time? And like, what is the main thing, if you say like one quality that makes you that quickly grow?
Well, the question that I always came up to was, why do I want to, was always there. I had the answer to the question. First time I wanted to grow was because I wanted to go on a mission trip to Africa and I didn't want to leave my practice for 2 weeks. So I hired an associate in advance and said, as soon as I hire my associate, I'm going to do this mission trip. And so I got an associate in, and within a few months, I was in Africa for a couple of weeks. And it turns out I didn't miss the money from being gone because we produced as much in the month before in the month. And that's always been the case.
How did you find an associate?
I've tended to had a pretty easy time over the years by just putting out an announcement. I don't usually go searching for them too much. I kind of like put out the word that I'm looking and people show up.
That's a good problem to have. A lot of people struggle to find. How did you were you skeptical at first? Like, you know, do I have enough to share? Do I want to share? I mean, I think that's a big question that owner doctors have. Frankly, especially baby boomers, is they're worried about, are they going to lose part of their nest egg by bringing in an associate? Is there enough to go around? How did you deal with that? Or do you just kind of...
My mindset has always been that I will provide. If I'm going to invite some dentist to come in to work with me, I'm going to provide for them, and I'm going to create, take mine. See, I'm not that good-hearted to where I'm going to give up my patients.
Yeah, but you're taking a proactive approach, which is very unusual for, I feel like, for most owner dentists.
I'm committed to the new guy coming in with me that they're going to be successful. I'll do anything to make them successful, but I'm not going to sacrifice myself for that. I'm going to give them my time, my training, and my blessing. When they get that, they get everything. That's the way I look at it. Because if they can have 50 new patients a month and they can't make it on that, that's too bad. I don't think they need to be there anyway. But luckily, all of them have stayed, and we've had a really good relationship with all the associates we've had for the most part over 40 years. 43 years I've been doing this, and I've had 18 associates.
Wow. So now you said you started doing TMJ. You had most of this production and money that would come from, or you were, because at the beginning when I had was talking to you, you said you do A to Z type of dentistry. With that type of growth, is there any specific type of dentistry that you do that it makes it that easily grow quick? Or what do you say about the
dentistry? You know, I didn't do any orthodontics for about 5 years, and I didn't do any oral surgery hardly for 4 or 5 years, where I was ticked off by some specialists because of different things that they refused to do for us when we would ask them. And we used to refer $50,000 to $100,000 of dentistry to them every year, and they wouldn't do things for me the way I wanted it. And so I just started learning how to do what they did.
Such as what exactly, if you want to tell? Because some people that are listeners are like a lot of specialists. Like, what would you say that they needed to do that they didn't?
Well, I was orthopedics back in the day with Whitzig and McNamara. And I had my orthodontist doing fixed edgewise and straight wire technique. And I asked him if he would use some functional appliances on my patients because the results would turn out better. And he wouldn't even consider it. You know, he said, those things don't work. And so that led me to take orthodontic courses from the United States Dental Institute for 5 years of doing anything that the orthodontist could do. And I've been doing it now for 35 years. And I actually became an instructor in the USDI Institute for about 5 years. So orthodontics came that way. As far as wisdom teeth, I didn't used to do wisdom teeth until the oral surgeon refused to see one of my associate's patients on a emergency basis. And it kind of ticked me off that he wouldn't take care of it. And when we had that meeting, it didn't go well. And so from that moment on, I never referred to another oral surgeon. I just started learning how to
do it.
I learned how to do my own stuff. And, you know, if 99% of the things I don't send out anymore because of bad relationships with people that just don't listen.
Well, and I'll say, I think the one thing that I think of when you talk about the orthodontics thing, in my short career and what I kind of tell younger dentists is that it's really important that as you develop your mindset and ideas and the way that dentistry is, whether it's TMJ related things, occlusal related things, you know, some of these hot topics or debated topics, that you work alongside people that have similar philosophies. Because if you don't, then you're going to have issues, you know, whether, you know, take something like even extracting premolars to ortho, some people don't believe in whatever. So, you know, if you don't, you need to make sure that you have an understanding. You know, it doesn't have to be a huge understanding. You need to have some understanding to where you believe and trust in the referring person. It's not just someone you refer to. Would you kind of agree with that, Doc?
Yeah. If you don't mix your philosophy properly, it'll never be a compatible relationship. And I think it's very dangerous for doing all the high-end specialty procedures because there are so many difficult things out there. So it's not like you should start doing them, but you do need to have a good working relationship with a specialist. And then if you can't find somebody to do it your way, then you got to learn your own way.
I always kind of like to refer it to like a to money. You know, a lot of people don't want to learn how to invest or do any of that. They want to have, that's the case, but you need to know enough to be able to like pick the right person, have a good conversation with them. I think it's the same thing with referring, especially you don't have to place implants, but you need to understand enough the lingo and the way it works to be able to have an intelligent conversation, to be able to judge whether you think that the referring person that you're referring to is doing it accurately or right and whatnot. Okay, so let's move on. So now you're in this giant massive practice that's I love the one building location mega practice versus the multiple practice idea. And it sounds like basically what y'all did is you basically and correct me if I'm wrong, but just stopped referring everything out of that practice, right? Like you, if you couldn't do it, you probably found someone else that could do it. Is that kind of correct? That basically everything in that practice could be done in-house?
That's right. We coined a term years ago called a decathlon dentistry, where, and maybe that's a term for people that say super generalist. I was a master of the Academy of General Dentistry since 2005 or so, and have always belonged to the Academy of General Dentistry and, you know, enjoyed being an officer in the state and doing all the things that the General Dentistry Academy supports. So I really believe in the AGD. Decathlon dentistry, though, is it takes three or four really good levels of expertise, you know, in different disciplines of dentistry to be very successful. And that's what most people come out of dental school being able to do, three or four things. But then if you really want to be a little more successful, you need to know five, six things. And when you get to know seven or eight things, you're really productive. Because think about it. You only have to have half the number of people to do the same amount of work. Your marketing goes a lot further. Your treatment plans go a lot smoother, and there's no big referral mess to get them in and out. And so that's one reason I always like to be able to address every issue one patient has.
No, I totally agree. That's kind of that's been what our mantra and mindset has been from the get-go. And part of the reason I think we're successful.
When I got to be about a $5 million practice, you know, my advisors, and it might be time for you to franchise this thing or to set up a second location. This thing is really working smooth. Do you want to do that? And I really thought about what that meant. And I decided I did not. I wanted to refocus myself and stay in one place. And so the mega practice was a lot more attractive to me than multiple locations with multiple overheads.
Is that because you like to control things where you see them, or main reason for that you like to have that mega practice versus having multiple locations where you're not really there? However, there are people producing for you while you're not there, because that's what I'm thinking for you. Like, because I'm just like you. Like, I love to be under one roof because I can manage things, but then I'm thinking, am I micromanaging other associate dentists that will be willing to work for me? Or what does that work out with your type
in our practice? I didn't micromanage our guys except for quality. If there was any quality issues, I always had to get involved, but usually there weren't. But the main thing that I liked was free time, and I wasn't interested in going over to some other office to manage it. I knew I would work in one and I would not work in two. When I first started out, my first 10 years of practice, I had 1 year or two practices with a dentist in each one. And I just got a funny feeling from that one experience back in probably 1984, 85, 86, that I didn't want to do that again. And so I was kind of jaded against having multiple facilities from the very get-go. I had one large one and one small one. And the small one just didn't make any money. It was a headache. I couldn't get people to go over there because they all wanted to come to me because they were too close together.
Right.
That was the big.
So how do you keep that many associates and then grow to $5 million? Did you allow the associates to buy in, to become partners, or are you the solo doc with all these associates?
I didn't ever have anybody buy in. No. There was times where I offered, partnership to people along the way, and down in Stone Mountain, none of them would take me up on it. You know, they all wanted to work and then go, and never did have anybody get very seriously. And up in Suwannee here, we've had pregnancy take away a couple. There was one issue that came up with, had a woman and my first associate in Suwannee. She got pregnant on pregnancy leave. I got another dentist to come in that was right out of school, and he was there for about 6 months, and his wife got pregnant. And so Rush Dentist was coming back from pregnancy leave. She said, well, I don't really want to come back after all. And so she didn't come back. And about 2 days later, the other dentist said his wife was pregnant. They wanted to move back to Alabama. And so I was there in November. I was left with no dentist and about a $2 million practice with all these patients. And so I put out notice, and it was pretty interesting, an experienced dentist within about 30 days. And he stayed with me for about 8 or 10 years. And he was productive because he was experienced, and he produced more than those other two had in the previous year, his first year.
So obviously you had to be paying them well then, because if I'm, you know, I'm impressed that you were able to grow that big of a practice and not have, was it not just a revolving door? I mean, 18 is, I'm just thinking from a standpoint of like that hard to keep, that I don't see a lot of practices that grow and do really well with constant associates if they're not partners or bought in, just because there's a significant take home difference in money. I mean, we're both a big advocate of people owning. Obviously, that hasn't been the case in your case, and you've been successful. I'm not, obviously you've been crazy successful, I imagine, since that's the case. But were they able to be successful as just associates too?
In the practice, and I sold it 5 years ago now, and I just work in the practice that I sold. But those guys that were working for me, I was paying them very high level, you know, like 35%. And they were really making some good money. Some of them were making $400,000 in a year as an associate working 4 days a week. And they were happy. And I was happy. I was making a lot more than that. And it was a good time.
That's a great time. Yeah. And when you have that kind of size, I guess, yeah, your overhead. I mean, what was your overhead when you were running that lean and with that many, with that big of a practice?
It was very good when I didn't have the big building. When I had 5 to 10 operatories, we were always extremely profitable. Then I sunk a bunch of money when I bought the building and some renovation. And so the profitability went down.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, you said something about when you're thinking about bringing an associate, you're going to give them patience, you're going to do this and that. And like, how do you feel the potential? Like, what do you see the potential, and how do you find patients that to where you're willing to give not your patients, but more patients? Like, is that something that you explain more in the book, that what is your philosophy regarding the potential to?
Well, I always felt like I could grow anything to the need that I had. And so every time I added an associate, we just marketed a little bit harder, a little bit more, and we got the patients to come in. And so we went from averaging 50 a month to 80 a month to 120 a month to 150 a month, and just depending on how many we needed. And so we just marketed. And I was coming up with this thing called web-centric marketing back in 19, when internet was a baby. And everything I did, we would focus to the internet and to our webpage. And I was the webmaster and would build websites for people, for other dentists even. And some of the nationally known dentists around the country, I made websites for them back in the early 95, 96, 98. And it just became something that I put all my energy into, the internet and when social media.
Sure. And then so the marketing, you did the marketing for the new guy coming in with your money, and then you were willing to pay whatever, 30%, 35% to the new guy. But was there a time, like, because I'm thinking, like, right now, if I hire an associate, they're not going to be any patient that would want to do general dentistry. They all come in to get implants. Like, why am I going to pay somebody else to just be there? But you say that is definitely bring more people as long as the marketing and the investment is done in a correct way.
Yeah, we always marketed for families, and we didn't market heavily for specifics at all. We always said we're the hometown dentist, you know, you all come and show up and we'll take care of you. And if they had needs for anything, we would do it. Orthodontics, TMJ. You asked me one time earlier tonight, what I make my big money on? What's the dentistry? And I've always since 1979, I've had a K7 kinesiograph and a mild monitor, and I've always done neuromuscular analysis on big cases. And so I've been setting up cases with the neuromuscular technique, and most people are familiar with the fact that LVI has been teaching that for the last number of years. But it originated in Seattle at Barney Jankelson's and Myotronics. And so I've been around the world in that area. And so setting up a case and doing a full mouth in 2 or 3 hours of prep time and an hour or two of temp time is normal for us. We can do 28 crowns in about 4 or 5 hours and be done with it.
That's impressive.
That's the way to go. You know, it's like once or twice a month, that makes a good month.
Now, that is there any current courses right now, LVIs, you said?
They do. They're in and out as far as what they teach about it. You know, sometimes they're doing what I think's the best. Sometimes they change instructors and it's not. So, you know, one guy that I always recommend is Clayton Chan in Las Vegas to teach really current stuff on what's good in neuromuscular. But there are several doctors that are highly trained in neuromuscular out there.
Let's talk about the book. So the book is a $10,000 a day dentist. That is, yes, that book right there. That obviously that's something what I like about the book is, and where I'd like to transition to kind of the rest of this conversation, the rest of this episode to, is basically I think that's a very attainable goal for a new graduate with you know, getting into practice. What would you say are some of the highlights in the talk about a young dentist, the mature dentist, and what was the other one that you talk about? Am I missing?
I've got one called the servant dentist, the one with the good heart. He wants to go and help people and do good things and kind of the missions guy.
Yeah.
And then there's a peak performance dentist. It's the one who's the hotshot, who wants to become the one who does the fancy things.
That would be Payman and I.
Payman. All on fours in his, you know, in his sleep.
I do. I dream about it all on four some days.
I know you do.
I talk about a dentist named Alex the God. Alex is a fictional dentist, of course, who meets five dentists along the way, and he mentors them. And he gets into conversations, and the conversations rally around history, their career status. And so, you know, they'll ask a question and Alex will answer it. And then Alex will give them some advice and he will take them down the path. And I take a couple of twists and turns in the book, like Alex interprets dreams that they have. He talks about some things that he's dreamed about. And really draw from what you learn in dental school to where you can get information outside of the normal dental channels. And the book has got some twists and turns like that in the back of it, where people are learning and they're taking advantage of the wisdom of the ages. You know, what do your mom and dad think about things? What do your pastors think about things? What do your friends that you travel the road to dentistry together? And so we try to weave a story in the book that lets people understand that dentistry is a journey. It takes a whole 30 or 40 years to understand it as well as they need to be highly productive. Now, some people will reach that highly productive stage in 10 years, or some will reach it in 15 years. But at some point in time, you reach a point where it's easy to, and that's one of the things that I've done and I've been able to do, is break down the barrier for dentists to see themselves and have the right mindset to where they can see themselves doing that on a daily basis. And I think one of the reasons that I wrote the book was because I had to do a lecture for my mastermind, and I wanted to do something that was very impactful that would change the lives of the dentist in that room. And so I just sit and I think on somebody. And then I came up with the idea that I'm more productive than most, and I tend to produce more per day than most. And I go, how do I do that? And so I made a list, and it came out to be about 50 things that I wrote down. And those 50 things I taught my guys in the mastermind. And lo and behold, within a month or two, they started doing $10,000 a day every day. Some of them were like doing $10,000 a day every day of a whole month. And I go, that's important. that really did sink in, and it is a teachable topic. It's a teachable moment. And so why don't we share that with the rest of dentistry? So that's why the book was written.
So those are the 50 things that you want, 50 things that you wrote down. Is that kind of like summarized in the book where people can take notes and be able to be productive on a daily basis?
Yeah, if you actually implement the thinking behind the recommendations that Alex gives each of the five dentists, you'll probably increase your practice. Just from reading the book, you'll probably increase your practice $50,000 a month, probably, because each idea has value tied to it. There's dollar signs tied to every good idea.
Could you give us an example, like a teaser for the book?
Well, any page in there, I could turn to any page and there's a key on there. So let me just turn to a page here and just find one that's kind of an interesting one. Okay, here's one called the new patient coordinator. How do you feel when you are escorted into a hotel room by a bellman and he draws the drapes, demonstrates how you operate the safe in the room, asks you if there's any questions before he leaves? Well, the new patient coordinator fills in the same role in our practice. They take the patient on a tour of our office before the dental staff goes in and does a tour of their mouth. The new patient coordinator shows the new patient the layout of the facility and introduces them to each team member that they encounter. They explain the photos, the diplomas, the certificates, and the mission memorabilia on the major piece of equipment. And I go on to talk about, you know, that's a paragraph in the book.
Yeah, that's filled with a lot of nuggets right there.
I talk about how the new patient coordinator sets the stage for me to get into the mind of the patient, to where they know us, we know them so well, and we build that rapport and trust so well in an interview before I go to the exam that they want whatever I'm telling. And so we're real big on creating trust and rapport in the exam through our new patient experience, which is a choreographed event, just like you have a play and people have a line they deliver at a certain time. They have places they have to walk on stage. Our staff is just like that.
That sounds amazing.
I like that.
Behind it. You know, it's also like an analogy of a football player. I'm the quarterback and all my team has got their own moves and we all have one play. When the new patient comes in, there's a play. We're running that play. And, you know, it might be a screen pass to the halfback. And so everybody's got a block. They've got a tackle. They've got to do all the right things for the patient to have a great experience. And so we're going through our motions and we're making that patient to be in that perfect place. And we're the ones that are going to serve them well.
No, you brought up a good fact or a point about patient coordinator. What about the other roles in your office within these years of practice? What have you learned that you could give us a little bit of a tip or how to be
a big tip, not a little one? How would you like me to save you 100 hours in a month?
I would like that.
Okay, here it is. Never give a consult. Never step foot in the consult room.
All right. Why?
Okay, I get 100 new patients come in. And how much production can a doctor do in 100 hours? A lot. I mean, 100 hours is like, okay, so if you don't have to talk to patients about treatment, about here's my treatment plan and here's all the things I'm going to do for you and here's how you're going to look and here's how you're going to be this and that, if you could turn that over to a staff member, totally delegate all consultations, which is what I've done for 25 years. I don't ever do consults. That would be valuable.
100%.
And so what I do is I don't even talk to the patient about, and I do them.
How much training did you do with your team for that, though? Because I think that's I totally see what you're saying. I think it's brilliant. My thing is I worry that how did you give up that? Because when you're wanting a team member to close a $60,000 treatment plan, you know, that's a hard thing for most dentists to let go. We're control freaks anyways, right? So that's a hard thing to let go. How'd you do that?
But if it's a question. Now, the thing about me is I've had two or three people do it over the last 40 years. So the people that are in that position are well paid and they're loyal and they know what they're doing.
Yeah. No, that's very, that's, I love that.
That's the true. Main thing. You have somebody that you can delegate.
So let's do this. I think this is a good conversation. Let's walk through. A patient comes into your office. They need some work done. They need a bunch of work done. At that point, you obviously have to come up with a treatment plan. So you're going to, I'm assuming you're doing that part, not a team member. Is that correct?
I'm always doing the treatment plans.
So at that point, then you've got the treatment plan, and then at that point, you're now, I'm assuming you've got to do an exam. You got to at least look in that patient's mouth. So then you've looked in their mouth, the x-ray has been taken, you walk out. Okay, so they go home, and then they're going to come back?
Yeah, we always have them come back, unless it's under $1,000, of course, something small.
Okay.
But anytime that there's a major treatment plan, we basically end our exam by saying, now I'm going to review all these radiographs and findings. And I'm going to study them tonight in quiet time when I don't have any distractions. I'm going to write down all the important things that I've found out into you, the best treatment for you. And this is going to be your 5-year plan. Now, it doesn't matter if you're going to have this treatment done over 2 months, 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years. It's your 5-year plan, because this is what's going to make you healthy and it's going to make you look good. So I kind of lay it out right there for them that there's no rush, there's no stress, there's no pressure, but this is a complete plan of me being able to give them the entire thing at one time without blowing them away. Because if I see that they're stressed out about money, and I've already found out that in my interview, by the way, the interview lets me know what their hot buttons are. If it's money, we don't have to push that button too hard. If it's time and they want to get it done quick, I know that. If it's they want to stretch it out over years, I know that. If they're insurance dependent, I know that. And so once I go into the exam, I do a verbal co-diagnosis thing that Omer used to talk about a lot, and Bob Barkley. We co-diagnose in front of them, so they hear us say it, they hear us write it down, and I'll say, I want you to come back and talk to Angie about the findings, and I'll be there if you need me. You can ask me any questions you want to. And the thing is, they never ask me any questions. They never come out of the consult room, but once every month, maybe once or twice.
Sure. That's impressive.
So today was a good example. I had a lady come in for a full mouth reconstruction. She's going to need an all-on-6 on top. She's going to need 3 implants on the bottom and crowns on the rest of the bottom teeth and a root canal. And I saw her Monday. She consulted today, and I'm doing the whole bottom on Thursday. How it can work.
But how did you know that? Okay, so I have a lot of patients that we have the same thing, but then we're like, shoot, we spend all this time, the patient doesn't have any money. How do you get your guys or the person that you work with that to understand, like, is there how would you find out? Because I know that it's such a gray area where, like, you want to present all the options and whatever, but if they only have like $3,000 and you're presenting that top 30, waste all that time. I'm not saying waste, but like, why do you spend all that? Like, how do you tackle that?
Our office attracts people with money, for one thing. You know, that's the thing. You always, we look like a Taj Mahal. And so you don't walk in thinking this is a cheap place. And so but that doesn't mean we don't serve a lot of poor people. We do. We have a whole lot of blue collar and poor people. But the thing is, we're not running people off by looking like a shack. And then when they come in, our expertise is on the walls and our training is evident. The staff that does the tour makes sure they know what we can do for them. And we're supposed to talk to the patient and find out their capability as we go along. And so there's no surprises. If they can't afford it, we've already found that out.
From the telephone conversation, do you ever give phone pricing over the phone?
No, we don't like to do that. That's not very common. Almost never give a price over the phone. Omer taught me to say things like during my exam, if it's a big case and I say, you know, this situation is pretty significant and, you know, we might be looking at a used car here. We might be looking at you got a Mercedes mouth going on right here. And so we'll use some terminology that they can relate to, you know, like, this is something that might be a new bass boat.
That's solid. Yeah.
And do they finance? Do you help them financing, or how do you get help?
Yeah, we always finance if they need it, but I don't do it out of my own account. It's always out of something like third party, you know, one of the lending club or something like that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, like you said, it's you have a system, and especially with all the training, with the years of putting into the dentistry, because you're pretty much right now, a lot of those hours that you're not putting in is because you put them in the 79 and 80s and all the training that you've taken that right now you can charge $30,000 or $20,000.
Well, I will say one of the things I like about you tonight is that a lot of the things, even the things we've just talked about that you're advocating, can increase young dentist success without a huge investment. So a lot of this is just some stuff as simple as how you talk to patients, how you co-diagnose, how you treatment plan, how you teach your team. There's a lot of value in a lot of these things that is not necessarily, oh, go buy a Combi, make, you know, $100,000 in CE. It's simple things that make a big difference. Would you kind of agree on that?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got those two things you mentioned in there, take CE and get a Combi. Those are in the book.
I like those.
Because they are significant.
Yes.
But the first thing I talk about in the whole thing under mindset, which is one of the five things you got to know, 100% readiness. You know, if it's just a simple thing like your team, when I walk in the room, you know what I want to see? I want the patient's mouth open, the topical already in there, and I've got the injection headed toward their mouth within a few minutes.
Yeah,
I love it. Being in the room.
I already want them numb, Dr. Bill, when I walk in. I already want them numb.
Well, I can't do it that way in our state.
Yeah, Georgia. That's unfortunate, man. That's nice.
It is very nice. Except
I tell you what, you could be. That takes a lot of that. That's a couple more minutes. All right, keep going though. Readiness. I love that.
One thing that really is important is KPI, and key performance indicators are KPI. You measure what you want to get done. And a lot of practice management consultants will really harp on measuring all the statistics. And I'm really good on that. I like to measure things that matter. And if they're measured against, they'll always improve. If you give a team something to measure the team, they'll improve. And so we set it up to where we had individual KPI, department KPI for the hygienist or the dental assistants or the front desk. And we also had a whole office KPI. And we were measuring and having competitions and having fun. And when they succeeded, they had big bonuses. And so that was the key that helped out everything. We rewarded people for the good times, and we actually never had any bad times, so we didn't have to take their bonuses away.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. Well, and what I've seen, the same thing, is that when you put them up for that to perform, it's amazing how they all of a sudden start delivering. I think since we implemented some different bonuses back in June, we haven't had a month where we haven't met goal. And we've had a couple or two right on there, but like, man, it's incredible.
No, I love it. I mean, I'm sure it's on Amazon. What about the first book, Marketing the $1 Million Practice? What about you? Or
which one should they buy first?
Yeah.
You should never buy one first. You should always buy both. Yeah. I mean, if you're a dentist looking for a bump in your practice, these two books are, you know, they're my first effort and my second effort to
And they're very short, which is good. I love short.
For $20,000, they did us.
I mean, I looked at this book and I got insulted. I'm sorry. I was like, why is it $10,000? But no, I'm kidding. It's good.
You know, if I put my real numbers on there, you wouldn't have bought the book because you would have think nobody could do that.
I believe it
for sure. I mean, being what you said and talking to you tonight, I'm very motivated to just go ahead and finish the book tonight or tomorrow, because this is not going to really take that much. But then I'm back with you on the show. I like to get him back because I'm going to implement a lot of things and I'm going to ask questions next time that what did you do this and that, because you have so much experience, especially dealing with associates, because I think that's another reason behind your success and having multiple offices with multiple associates producing that much, yet you be the owner and they're not even taking a part, which to me, that sounds amazing. But at the same time, I'd love with you coming in.
Sure, sure. Yeah, one thing I've enjoyed is that all my associates that we have three of them right now that are my partners because I'm an associate actually with them. But we all will do over 100,000 a month. And that's pretty unusual to have that many. And these are all millennials, by the way. These are young guys.
I love it.
Gosh.
Dang.
Yeah.
So good.
How you get people from the schools and set your reputation, pretty much your associates find you, but are they mostly from Georgia schools or Tennessee or Alabama or?
Right now, everybody, all four of us went to the Medical College of Georgia, which is unusual, but our undergraduate schools are Georgia, Auburn, Georgia Tech, and Central Florida. In Auburn and Central Florida are playing in the Peach Bowl. It'll be fun. So it's fun in our office. And Georgia and Auburn went after each other, you know, this weekend, and we got our ass kicked.
That's true.
Yeah, you know,
Auburn.
It's hard to be the same team twice. That's what I always say.
Hard to be the same team.
Well, yeah. Well, we had a good week the week before on, you know, playing Alabama, and week before that playing Georgia. So I'm not complaining.
No, not at all. Well, Dr. Brill, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great episode. We'll want to do it again at some point, possibly in the spring.
And we're going to put all the contacts and your contacts or whatever you, how it's.
How can people get in touch with you? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I would like people to reach me through solsticedentaladvisors.com/mastermind.
Perfect. solsticedentaladvisors.com/mastermind.
For the. You know, the teaching I do is on Amazon, and you can go there and you can get either one, the marketing, the $1 million practice, or the $10,000 day dentist. And if you'll just overlook a few typos on the first book, I'll be very pleased.
We'll let that slide. Neither one of us are going to catch them. That's for sure. We're definitely not the gamer people.
You said something about teaching. When is the next course that you're teaching right now?
We got a mastermind starting up in January, buddy, about that.
And these are mostly concentrated around TMJ or ortho or all the above.
Oh, no. No, I don't teach any of the tactics that were clinical. I always do practice management and practice growth now.
So how are your masterminds done? Are they done, they were done remotely or are they done locally?
Live, right here in my home. We have 9 dentists in a mastermind.
All right. How many times do you meet?
Right here at home. 3 times a year. So it's a total of 6 days in Atlanta.
Awesome. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I invite anybody in America or overseas if you want to come. We had an Australian come. We've had Canadians. So we invite people from all over.
That's pretty cool. All right, Doc. Well, thanks so much. Everybody continue to work smarter.
Not harder.
Not harder. And we will see you next time. Thanks, Doc. Have
a
weekend.
Thank you, Doc.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.